The following talk was given at the Insight Meditation Center in Redwood City, California. Please visit our website at audiodharma.org. Good evening. Good evening. Welcome. Welcome. It's a Buddhist practice. It might seem like it's a solitary affair, something that we do by ourselves. There's certainly, in the suttas, a lot of emphasis on becoming awakened and this idea that we are the ones that walk the practice, walk the path, do the practice for ourselves. And certainly we sit in meditation with our eyes closed. But the more we practice, the more we realize how we're connected. And specifically, we recognize nothing arises for no reason, no experience, no object, nothing. Everything arises for a reason. Maybe unless we want to talk about the unconditioned, which I'm not going to talk about tonight. So with this recognition, we could say that the path, or this path of practice, in some ways brings us into the web of life more fully, recognizing and appreciating, feeling some connections that perhaps before we weren't so sensitive to, instead feeling separated, independent, isolated perhaps. But rather than cutting us off from one another, instead this practice can kind of highlight our relationships and nourishing an appreciation for the ways in which we're connected. And certainly the Buddha is often depicted as a solitary figure. It's pretty rare, certainly in this tradition, to see anything except a Buddha by himself sitting. And if you read in the suttas, some of them use this word seclusion, this idea of being separated. But one way we can interpret that is that in ancient India, the society was a little bit different than how it is now, and kind of the bonds of family and community were really closely knit. And so this sense of individuality or doing something to quiet the mind maybe needed to be highlighted in that time. And to be sure, also, Buddhism grew. I mean, the Buddhism as a religion, as a tradition, as a practice, grew out of a sense of community and connection, to be sure, right? That at the time of the Buddha, the community, whether they were monastics or lay, whether they were women or men, they had to rely on each other in order to hear the teachings. Of course, they certainly couldn't tune into YouTube or listen on Audio Dharma or something like this, right? They didn't, at the time of the Buddha, they weren't written down. The only way you would hear about the Dharma is with an interaction with another person, is with somebody speaking it, and you were hearing it, and perhaps you were talking, or maybe you were just listening, or maybe it was chanting and just listening. So individuals had to rely on each other in order to hear the teachings. And of course, they were preserved, right, through all these thousands of years, because people thought they were valuable and even sacred and chose to preserve them. So Buddhism, these practices, of course, is really dependent on some of these relations of people passing things on from one to the next. So one thing that we might notice or might know is that actually the Buddha, he placed immense emphasis on the company we keep. And in the suttas, there is this passage where the Buddha is saying, I do not see even a single thing that so causes wholesome qualities to arise as good friendship. I do not see even a single thing that so causes wholesome qualities to arise as good friendship. So this recognition that, especially back then, right, they were completely dependent on who they knew or who they had access to or who they spent their time with. And there's also this passage, just as the dawn is the precursor for the arising of the sun, so too, having a good friend is the precursor for developing the Noble Eightfold Path. Many of you know the Noble Eightfold Path is a path to awakening, has eight elements to it, hence the name. I'm not going to go into the details of what that is, but just this recognition that having a good friend is the precursor for developing the path to awakening. And maybe I'll say just for me that meeting people that were practitioners of the Dharma that had more experience than I did and had such a big impact to somehow to be able to talk about the Dharma after the Dharma talks or something, or to see people who, how they moved through the world and how they handled things, to learn from them and to see how they seemed to have much more ease in their life than I was having, and to be inspired by, okay, so there were the teachings, but there's also people who are listening to these teachings and putting them into practice. And I think it's, I could honestly say that my life would have turned out differently if I hadn't had the great good fortune to meet some Dharma practitioners and to develop some of these friendships. So this, and maybe I'll say also that some of you know that now when we do so many things on Zoom and it's also on YouTube, that, and certainly when we were live here at IMC in person, that there's so many practices that we do, so many courses that we do, so many offerings in which we try to make these opportunities in which people can connect with one another, whether that's the small practice groups for in-person or when we're on Zoom, we're doing breakout rooms. If you're sitting retreats, they're often practice discussions or group practice discussions. There's also in the beginning and the ending of the retreat often some breakout rooms. Just this recognition that we learn a lot from each other, and also this recognition that everybody has some wisdom. Of course they do. I heard this quote once. Now I can't give an attribution because I don't remember, but this idea that nobody is smart enough to be completely wrong. Like you would have to know everything that's right in order to make sure that it's wrong. Or I don't know, I like this idea. But all of us have wisdom that we can share with others. So the Buddha, of course, recognized this as well. So there's this story in the suttas about Meghya. Meghya was the Buddha's attendant before Ananda was the attendant. And going for alms round one morning, Meghya saw a mango grove that seemed attractive to him, that seemed compelling, and he wanted to practice there. So he asked the Buddha, I'd like to go practice there in the mango grove and meditate for the day. And the Buddha said, why don't you wait, because nobody else is here. And he was the Buddha's attendant, and the Buddha wanted him to stay. But Meghya insisted, and the Buddha said, okay, you can go. So then Meghya goes to the mango grove and sits to meditate. And he had a difficult time. He had a hard time. So he returned to the Buddha and reported what had happened when he was at the mango grove. And here's what he says. Bhante, which is a word for like teacher or Well, teacher or something. Bhante, while I was dwelling in that mango grove, I was overcome by three kinds of harmful, unwholesome thoughts. Sensual thoughts, aversive thoughts, and cruel thoughts. It then occurred to me, this is astounding and incredible. Out of faith, I have left the lay life and became a monastic. Yet I am filled with these three kinds of harmful, unwholesome thoughts. Right, so Meghia is maybe like surprised that even though all of his practice and he's dedicated his life to be a monastic, he's dedicated his life to practice, and he still has these unwholesome thoughts, sensual thoughts, aversive thoughts, cruel thoughts. And not only has he become a monastic, he is the attendant of, some would argue, the best meditator that humankind has known. And yet, he himself is still, he's probably heard countless numbers of Dharma talks, but he's not quite able to himself to find the meditation that is not without sensual thoughts, aversive thoughts, and cruel thoughts. So he goes back to the Buddha. And he tells him just what I said. And then the Buddha responds, Meghya, when mental liberation has not fully ripened, that is, when they're not completely awakened, there are five things which are conducive to full ripening. What, five? So now the Buddha is going to let him know, what, here are some things that he can do. One. The Buddha doesn't say one. This is my editorial edition. Meghya, when one has good spiritual friends, good spiritual companions, good spiritual associates. Two, one is virtuous. Three, one, there are conversations which are supportive for developing humility and helpful for opening one's mind. Four, one has energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. And five, one is wise, endowed with the wisdom that knows the arising and passing of experiences. So then the Buddha continues. So Meghya, when one has good spiritual friends, good spiritual comrades, good spiritual associates, it can be expected that they will be virtuous. It can be expected that they will have conversations which are supportive for developing humility and helpful for opening one's mind. When you have good spiritual friends, it can be expected that you'll have the energy for abandoning unwholesome qualities and acquiring wholesome qualities. And when one has good spiritual friends, one will be wise, endowed with the wisdom that knows arising and passing. So here the Buddha is pointing out that if we are associating with the right people, it's more likely that we'll have some of these other qualities that can help us on this, on the path towards awakening. And we saw that with the earlier quote where the Buddha is saying that just like the dawn is the precursor of the morning, so good spiritual friends is a precursor to developing the Noble Eightfold Path. But one thing that I appreciate about this passage is that there's these three different words, spiritual friends, companions, and associates. Translators can argue about, you know, exactly which way to translate them, but the point is that it's three different words. So I'm interpreting them as three different levels of intimacy. Some are good friends. Maybe some people are just those that you see. Maybe you don't have a relationship with, but you see their, the way that they move in the world, the way that they show up, or some action that they do. Sometimes when we're on meditation retreats in person, probably all of us have had this experience where we're doing something, going to the hall, leaving the hall, going into the dining hall, whatever it might be, and we see somebody who is behaving really in a mindful way. It's like, oh, right, I'm supposed to be mindful. So maybe that's just somebody that's sharing the space, a fellow retreatant. So there's different levels. There's good friends that we might have. Maybe there's people that we would only chat with or when we see them in the Zoom breakout rooms, for example. Maybe we don't speak with them outside, but maybe then, and we're happy to see them and share with them our experience. Or maybe there's people that we don't really know, but we see and are inspired by. So we could interpret this that the Buddha recognized that our minds have a whole range of potential. We can have this selfishness, aggressiveness, and sensual thoughts, thoughts of cruelty, thoughts of just some general unwholesome, unhelpful thoughts. All of us have this potential. In the same way, all of us have the potential for wisdom and compassion, kindness and warmth. And the Buddha also recognized, of course, that we don't live in these hermetically sealed vacuums. Our minds are not completely independent. Of course we are influenced by others. Of course we are influenced by our environment. This is why the Buddha often suggested, you know, going to the foot of the tree and meditating, you know, going off into seclusion. But he also suggested that you have good spiritual friends. And we can say, well, what's the definition of a good spiritual friend? And we could say it's one that supports your practice, supports this movement towards greater freedom, some greater ease. So which of these potentials for unwholesome thoughts or wholesome thoughts, which ones of these gets realized, is influenced by our environments, our friends? And maybe we could also bring into this which media we consume. Dharma books or social media in which the intention is to be inflammatory and divisive, or news sources. This memory, right, that news sources, all of them have a business model. And their business model is to get readers. So of course they are going to point out things that are catchy or grab our attention. Maybe they're not all inaccurate, but maybe they have a particular point of view in which they're emphasizing the worst or the best or something like this. And maybe others just silently speak to the hidden potentials within us. Maybe there's something inside of us that gets inspired when we see another, or we read a Dharma book, or listen to a Dharma talk, or have some Dharma friends worth we talk about. I think all of us probably can look back on our lives and see, oh yeah, why being influenced by different people. Even, you know, parents sometimes will restrict kids from, you know, I don't think you should spend so much time with these kids. I notice that when you do that you're cussing a lot or whatever it is, whatever it might be. So in the suttas, there's also where the monastics help one another. And at the opening scene of the Anapanasati Sutta, that is the discourse on mindfulness of breathing. Mindfulness of breathing, of course, is a key practice that we do. And reading that sutta, I was primarily interested in, you know, the steps with breathing, these 16 steps, the four tetrads. But I never forgot this opening scene that really did touch me. And it goes something like this. Now, at that time, the senior monastics were advising and instructing the junior monastics. Some senior monastics instructed 10 monastics, while others instructed 20, 30, or 40. And being instructed by the senior monastics, the junior monastics realized a higher distinction than they had before. So just this small little, I don't know, often we tend to kind of like throw away some of these sentences in the suttas, but this recognition that there's a teaching going on. And I believe my understanding is even in today's monasteries, there's a lot of teaching that happens between the monastics. And here's one that I'd like to share. This is from the Terikata. That is, these are the verses from nuns that have been awakened. And this is from the nun Uttama, and she's describing a little bit of her story of how she became awakened. It goes like this. 4 or 5 times I left my dwelling. I had failed to find peace of heart or any control of my mind. I approached a nun in whom I had faith. She taught me the Dharma, the aggregates, sense fields, and elements. When I had heard her teaching, in accordance with her instructions, I sat cross-legged for 7 days without moving, given over to rapture and bliss. On the 8th day, I stretched out my feet, having shattered the mass of darkness. Quite something to sit for 7 days. I don't know if we should take this literally or not, but I appreciate very much she starts this nun. I had failed to find peace of heart or any control over my mind. So then she goes to a nun in whom she had faith. So maybe she had noticed this other nun. Maybe she had noticed, or maybe this nun was Padachara. We don't know. It might be Padachara. Some of you know that we have a Padachara statue. This right here now is the Buddha. But we also have one that's Padachara, who's down at the retreat center. And she was one of the premier nun teachers, one of the first teachers. So perhaps it was Padachara, but perhaps it was another nun that Uttama went to, received some teachings, and then she did the teachings and became awakened, shattered the mass of darkness. The mass of darkness we can understand as being ignorance or delusion, so that she saw clearly. So what is it? What would it take to have these good spiritual friends? Often it's not easy to, using this expression, good spiritual friends, the translation of Kalyanamitta. Some of you may be familiar with that expression. There's a number of different ways we can translate it, but I'll keep it as good spiritual friends. And so to develop these types of friendships probably requires some patience, some deliberate effort. Of course, being friendly and having warmth and being a good listener, right? Everybody knows this. You don't need me to tell you this, but maybe these types of relationships grow, of course, like all relationships, with honesty and being authentic and not trying to be more spiritual or something like this, right? Not trying to fit ourselves into some mold. But not only that, is a willingness to learn from and be supported by others. That is, to be teachable. There are some people who just feel uncomfortable with the idea that somebody else might know something that they don't know, or they just have to spend their energy showing how much they know and aren't really teachable. So in order to have these good spiritual friendships, we have to be willing to be teachable. And can we be inspired by others without a feeling of envy, without a feeling of, oh, they have everything, I don't have anything, you know, without our inner critic getting activated? Maybe there's a little bit of envy. Maybe a little bit of the inner critic gets activated, but not in a way that it is a hindrance or is a burdensome or problematic for our relationships. Can we just recognize that other people's lives unfold differently than ours? Of course they do. Of course they do. Earlier I was talking about how we're all kind of connected. So there's all these conditions. People have been influenced by different conditions, different people in their lives. So of course their lives unfold differently than ours. Can we receive feedback, either directly or indirectly? We might notice, as I said earlier, that when we see somebody who's being mindful, our mindlessness might be highlighted. Or maybe when we see when somebody's, their speech is really clean, they don't gossip, they aren't divisive, they're not, you know, speaking in such a way that it's denigrating to anybody. And that might be a way which can highlight for us, oh yeah, when I was complaining or wanting to talk about somebody else, they didn't join me in this. Instead, maybe they kind of like skillfully changed the topic. Or maybe we do have some conceit about our meditation practice or our attainments that we believe that we've had, and we feel like we somehow feel like we have to show them or let people know. But maybe it might be softened if we spend time with people who hold themselves lightly or perhaps don't even show any interest in our spiritual attainment, so to speak, but instead they are interested in just us as individuals. So this is part of being a good spiritual friend, and maybe I'll also say not being attached to our views or our group. That is, are we just looking for confirmation of what we already know? Or are we open to learning from other people that are different from us? Maybe have different life experiences, have different backgrounds, have different meditation experiences. So this idea of cultivating good spiritual friends is such an integral part of our practice. And the Buddha recognized this, and I'm sure all of us recognize this too, how this practice to walk with others. But of course, not in a way in which we give up our discernment, not in a way in which we give up our ability to say, this doesn't quite feel right, and to not give up our autonomy or anything like this, but instead to allow ourselves to be influenced and to use our wisdom so that we can be not only have good spiritual friends, but be a good spiritual friend. And in this way, we can kind of, with this connectedness that we recognize that we have with each other, one another, that we can support one another. And maybe those who feel supported can support yet other people. And in this way, the support can grow and more people benefiting from our practice. So may all beings benefit from our practice. Thank you.